Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. Looking for a good book to read? We can help a little bit later in the program, but first, evaluating what we read, see, and hear is becoming increasingly important in today's world. It requires a skill to ensure that what we are hearing and seeing is what it professes to be. Is the political message accurate? The ad, the newspaper, television, or radio news story? Or does someone have a motive to dupe or mislead? We can all hone our skills to more accurately evaluate the message and the messenger. Our guest today can tell us how. She's Julie Smith, a media literacy educator, author of Master the Media, How Teaching Media Literacy Can Save Our Plugged-In World. She's also an adjunct professor at both Webster University and SIU in Edwardsville. Julie, so nice to see you.
Thank you, Don.
Let's begin with the basics to make sure everybody knows what we're talking about. I'll ask you for your definition of media literacy.
Media literacy is the ability to critically analyze, evaluate the media that we consume daily. The average American spends about 11 hours a day with the mass media. So to be media literate doesn't mean that you hate the media at all. You don't bash it. You understand it. You critique it. You appreciate how it's made, what the intent is, and who the messenger is.
We will get into that with a little more in a little more detail in just a moment. But I'm intrigued by the subtitle of your book, How to Save Our Plugged-In World. Save Our Plugged-In World?
I know. It's an ambitious title, isn't
yeah.
it? I tend to say that media literacy can save a lot of society's problems, and that seems like an overgeneralization, maybe really idealistic, but I believe it. Because if we were critical consumers and able to discern what is really important, what's not, what's really true and what's not, what's meaningful and what's not in all the media we consume, I think we'd be better consumers, we'd be smarter voters, we'd be more likely to appreciate what's important and less likely to be sheep.
I would think that this would become even more complicated in today's digital world.
It is, absolutely, yeah. Because most of the media we consume happens on the screen. Mm-hmm. So it's visually based, which means it's very easy to manipulate. So there's a special skepticism that's required when dealing with visual communication. And it's a whole language in itself of how colors communicate, the angles, the photographs, the headlines, everything sends a message, whether we realize it or not. So it's fun to kind of pull back the curtain on how the messages are created so that we can kind of see what the motives are.
Do you have any examples that you can give of where the message has been somewhat distorted and perhaps misinterpreted?
How much time do we have, Don?
I have a few myself, by the way.
I can imagine. Yeah. I can imagine. Well, there was a meme that circulated on Facebook yesterday. And that's what's so fun about this topic is because it's so current. You know, I get to update my classes every day because the media is changing every day. So there was a meme that went around Facebook yesterday, and it said that President Obama had renamed Mount McKinley Denali because Denali is the Kenyan word for black power. Share and repost if you agree. And it had been shared 7,111 times. But it was created, you know, there was a picture of the mountain and it had the meme font, you know, which gives it, which our brains see as instant credibility, just visually. So 7,000 people had shared this, even though we know that that's not factually accurate. But a lot of times we tend to share and believe messages that already affirm our held beliefs, because that makes us feel good.
Okay. Well, we get a message like that. How do we go about evaluating it to determine in our own mind whether we should accept it or not?
Well, you know, as a reporter, Don, you got to check your sources, mm-hmm. right? Always check your sources. So when I found this meme, of course, I used several tools online to figure out where it originated. And it originated from a very religious group in the South that was campaigning for one particular representative. I actually can't remember the name. But clearly it was created by someone on their computer. The tools, and that's, you know, that's a neat thing and a dangerous thing, because the tools we have online, we can create things that look legitimate.
Oh, yeah.
And so it gets harder and harder every day to determine what's real and what's valid. There's some great tools online where you can search for the actual source of images, but that takes work and time, and really a lot of people aren't willing to do that.
A lot of people, I would say 99.9% of the people. I mean, let's be real about this.
Well, no, that's very true. And plus, if it's if it looks like news and it looks like something that affirms what you already believe, why check it? You don't want to check it. You want to share it because it confirms your already held beliefs.
Well, you know, that sounds like something that is not going to really help us very much in this whole world of media literacy. If it takes too much time to do, if it affirms what we already believe, the battle is won.
I think that awareness actually is the first step. Yesterday in class, I showed a lot of viral photos. Some were fake, some were real, and had the class determine whether or not they thought that it was true or not. And several of the students were saying, oh, I wish this was true. If it was like a negative picture of Hillary Clinton or a negative picture of Sarah Palin, like, oh, I wish this was true. And I would stop and say, why? You know, is that wish, the wish that you have that this is true, is that making it more believable for you?
Well, you know, I keep going back to how do you teach people? I mean, you can go to the source if you can go to the source.
And if you want to have time
If you want to have time. It's just something I think most people are not going to be inclined to do. But how do you teach them how to do it? Let's talk about kids. Let's talk about the fifth grader.
Really, I think a technique that works with the younger kids is to teach them how they're being used. Like there's all these studies about how we use the media, but no one talks about how the media use us. And when I do workshops for like middle schoolers and high schoolers, it's really fun to see their little eyes light up when I teach them how they're being manipulated. Like if you let them think that you're letting them in behind the curtain and teaching them all the tricks that are being used, I think that they're more likely to pay attention because they want in on the joke. You know, it's not preaching to them necessarily. It's saying, let me show you how they're doing this so that you can outsmart them.
Oh, again, let me ask you for an example with regard to that fifth grader, because I do know, knowing something about media literacy, that the big objective now is to start teaching it early in school so that kids can kind of get used to the notion and do exactly what you're saying. But give me an example of for the five-year-old.
Five-year-old, that's tough.
A fifth grader, I'm sorry.
Okay, fifth grader. What I would do with a fifth grader is I would start about asking their favorite TV shows. Okay, and tell me about the characters in those TV shows. Are there any characters in those TV shows that remind you of your friends? What personality characteristics do these characters have? Are there any that you wish you had? How do they dress? Where do they go to school? How often do they do their homework? Where do they live? How do they talk to their friends? It's a very different world in television land than it is in reality, right? And I think that once you can give them the ability to really analyze what they're watching, it's not a magic bullet, but at least if it gets them thinking, that's a step in the right direction.
Do you have any experience of your own to indicate that it works with youngsters?
Well, I have three teenage sons. One is a freshman at Mizzou who just went through his first psychology class, and the psychology professor had a hypnotist come, and he was planning on hypnotizing the class, and my son didn't go for it. And he congratulated my son for the critical thinking. Mm-hmm. So he told me, I was raised to always be skeptical of everything. And that, I think that's really, really important because the teachers are so into the Common Core State Standards, mm-hmm. and critical thinking is such a part of that. Instead of just consuming something, really thinking about it and analyzing it. And the earlier the better.
Yeah. It doesn't seem like a very positive way to go through life, though, by being skeptical of everything.
There's a fine line between skeptical and cynical, right? Mm-hmm. You don't want to be cynical of everything. I kind of equate being media literate as being a food critic. Food critics don't hate food. They love food, right? Mm-hmm. But a food critic analyzes the ingredients, how it's prepared, the chef, the kitchen, the restaurant, how it's presented on the plate, what it tastes like, what the texture's like. So they're getting a full analysis of the food rather than just saying this tastes good or tastes bad. Mm-hmm. And that's how I kind of equate media literacy. It's not bashing. It's not hating. It's just merely being aware of the message, the sender, and what their intent is.
What advice do you have for all of us who are being subjected in ever-increasing number and quality to the political ads of the day?
Oh, golly. They're annoying, aren't they?
I mean, this is where you can become cynical and just say, I'm not going to believe any of them because I know they're twisting and manipulating.
I think it's very difficult to not be cynical in today's political world through the media. And that's too bad. So I'm going to go back a little bit when we talk about media consumption and attention span, okay? Because policies and politics itself are actually pretty boring, for lack of a better term.
Right? Not this year.
Well, if we're going to talk about here's an example. All of my students can tell you that there's crisis in the Middle East. Nobody can actually tell us the context of the story. Mm-hmm. Because it's 3,000 years of human history. It takes a really long time, right? So,
but that's the fault of the journalists for not putting it in context.
That's very true. But those journalists are also employed by privately held profit-seeking corporations who are very interested in ratings and need to get stories out quickly and currently. So, I mean, I'm not even sure if there was a two-hour show on CNN about the history of the conflict in the Middle East. Do you think would people watch? I mean, I'm not sure our attention spans could handle it.
Not if American Idol were on in competition.
That's very true.
How
close are we to American Idol taking over our presidential elections?
Well, we've got a reality person running
it. Yes, we do. Yes, we do. Truth is no longer stranger than fiction.
Tell me about the format of your book. It's a little bit different. We've had a number of programs on media literacy. There are a number of books out there. How is yours different? Is there a format that makes it exceptional?
I can tell you two criticisms of my book that I actually took as a compliment. Mm-hmm. One was that it wasn't academic enough. And I wear that as a sense of pride because I didn't want to write a book for professors. I wanted to write a book about media literacy for every parent and every teacher. I didn't want it to be highbrow. Okay, so it's very accessible. It's not a textbook at all. The other criticism that I had was that they couldn't believe that I would write a chapter about advertising and not include any advertising images within the chapter. Mm-hmm. Well, the media, the way it is, the minute that the book would be published, those pictures would be out of date. So at the end of each chapter of my book, I have QR codes that will take the reader straight to specific websites that I update daily with current examples.
These are the barcodes that we're familiar with.
Yes. They look just like a barcode, and there's links also on the Kindle version of the book. So it'll take you straight to all of the online resources that I use personally. So the book is like a starting point that takes you to every resource I've ever collected or used in my 15 years of teaching.
What are some of those resources? I'm familiar with Snopes, for instance, as many people
would be. Oh, I love Snopes.
Yeah.
Yes.
But, I mean, that's one. What are some of the others that are out there?
There are some fantastic media literacy groups that have websites full of lesson plans and ideas of questions to ask your kids while you're watching TV together or watching movies. One of my favorite online resources is my Pinterest board that I keep of photoshopping disasters and news mistakes. And I also have a Pinterest board of viral news photos. Mm-hmm. So you can go through and determine whether or not they're fake or real. And like I said, the fun part about that is that I can keep it perfectly updated.
Yeah, and there's plenty of that out there. So people they can go to Google and find them from there.
Absolutely. So the book is actually divided up by chapter. There's a one medium per chapter. So it talks about television. There's a chapter about movies, music, the publishing industry, the radio industry, social media, which of course is huge, the internet. And I try to tie it all up and make it accessible for everybody.
Yeah. We have to take a break now. We are talking with Julie Smith, the author of Master the Media, How Teaching Media Literacy Can Save Our Plugged-In World. We'll come back and continue the conversation. If you'd like to be a part of it, we'd love to have you. Do you have any experiences with having been duped, perhaps, by the media, any of the media that Julie has mentioned? Give us a call at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. Or send us an email to talk@stlpublicradio.org or send us a tweet at STL on Air. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back. We'll be continuing our conversation with Julie Smith about media literacy in just a moment. But first, here are some of the stories our St. Louis Public Radio newsroom is following today. The director of the U.S. Justice Department's Community-Oriented Policing Services held a news conference this morning to discuss a new federal report about the law enforcement response to unrest last year in Ferguson. Ron Davis's local police officials should be applauded for requesting the review. Missouri Attorney General Chris Costa released a report today that concludes that radiation and other pollutants have moved outside of the perimeter of the Bridgeton landfill. A citizens group says it is not surprised by those findings and that it's time for the landfill's owner to clean up the site. And two St. Louis men accused of planning bomb attacks during protests in Ferguson were sentenced today in federal court in St. Louis. Olajuwon Davis and Brandon Baldwin were each given 7 years in prison. You can learn more about these and other stories this afternoon on St. Louis Public Radio and throughout the day at stlpublicradio.org. Now back to the conversation with Julie Smith. Julie, you mentioned parents working with kids. You know, a lot of kids don't listen to their parents. That may come as a surprise to you. And you talk about sitting there watching television and the parents are telling them how to critically think. I question that, how that's going to work.
No, you're absolutely right. In fact, when I do social media workshops around town, a lot of times people will say, will you come and please talk to my kids? Because they will listen to a stranger more than they will listen to me. And I think that's true. You know, if anything, I think that media literacy and my book actually would help parents just know what questions to ask. You know, a parent's not going to sit down and say, okay, Johnny, let's sit and critically evaluate the show together. But they might ask some questions like, hey, why do you think that commercial was on during that show? Or do you think that commercial was aimed at boys or girls? Mm. Or, you know, are there things about that show that you enjoy? What is it? Just conversation starters. And then as they get older, then you move into different conversations.
Well, here's the problem as I see it, and that is that they're not sitting down together watching a television program because the kids are texting or doing whatever on their telephone, their
right.
tablet, or their computer, and the parents have no idea what they're being subjected
to. Right, the parents don't have any idea. But here's the thing. There's this idea that kids are digital natives and they know how to do all this automatically. Mm-hmm. They still need our help, and not just from like a technological point of view, but especially with social media, this is very much the way that they are determining their value and worth by the number of Instagram mm-hmm. likes and Twitter followers.
Sure.
And I'm not sure enough parents really know that. So maybe that's the first step, is getting parents aware of conversation starters to have with their kids about how they're using social media, what it's making them feel like, and trying to engage them in conversation, which I think is key. And hopefully some schools are starting to pick up on media literacy too, which helps.
Well, that's the next step. If kids aren't talking to their parents, as often the case, the person that they might go to or the person they might interact with would be their teacher.
Right.
What are teachers doing in this area?
Well, teachers, God bless them, they have so much on their plate already. And media literacy has a tough road in that department because there's really no place to put it. Right. You know, if you say geometry, well, then everybody knows where geometry goes.
Yeah.
But media literacy is a different animal and it's really cross-curricular. So the book helps with that. And I do workshops, too, about helping teachers implement media literacy ideas into the lessons that they're already teaching. So it's not adding another hour to the day. It's not adding another teacher to the faculty role. It is training teachers how to already use this material in what they're using. And, you know, we spend so much time with the media, but nobody ever stands back and says, maybe we should talk about this. Maybe we should talk about how this is affecting us. And I think now the momentum is starting to build where people are starting to think about how to implement this in schools.
We have some callers, and I want to take the calls, but we have an email here that creates an interesting scenario. How do we know we can trust Snopes or any of the other fact checkers?
Or me, for that matter.
Or me.
That's right. I tell my students they should have a little internal detector. Go with your gut. Little internal detector going off all the time. And maybe that is a snarky way to say healthy skepticism. But that's true. I mean, we don't know that Snopes is right.
There's a lot of stuff going on out there that is in more or less, in a sense, invisible. It's going on, but we don't know it. There's no way to detect it. I mentioned to you before you went on the air that Senator McCaskill, in a recent book, pointed out that she manipulated the campaign of Todd Akin during the primary campaign because she wanted to run against him. Nobody knew that until she wrote the book.
Right.
How are we going to pick up on stuff like that? It's out there, but so totally underground.
That is $1 million question. I have no idea.
Yeah.
And that's a toughie. And if she's doing it, who else is doing it? I mean, these kind of things could be happening all the time and we're not aware.
She says everybody does it. You know, and that may or may not be true. I guess the value of knowing that is knowing that it does happen has happened and probably will happen again.
Right.
And that you should not be a sucker and just accept everything that you've heard. Right.
Right. And what she's essentially done is help us lift the veil so that we can all see the man behind the curtain. Right. So
that's actually helpful.
Yes.
That she has done that.
It absolutely is.
Let's take a couple of phone calls. We'll start with Debbie calling from Belleville. Debbie, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. I have a strange question. It's probably too fresh to even do, but I've been duped before. The picture that made the rounds yesterday of the little boy in Turkey, is that true?
Yes. And it was actually on the front page of the Wall Street Journal this morning.
But that doesn't make it true.
No, that doesn't make it true, but that gives it credibility in the eyes of many, many people. That picture actually kind of bothered me, and so I looked it up. And there are much more graphic versions of that story on Yahoo. But again, we don't know exactly where or when that happened, but it is presented to us as fact. So,
yeah.
Debbie, I don't know. It's a toughie.
It's haunting me. I just can't figure out what we can do. I don't know.
And you know what? You bring up a really interesting point, and we talk about this in class and in the book, too. Photojournalism in news is so powerful. We see a millisecond of something that happened. We don't know what happened before or after that photo was taken. And they elicit real strong emotional responses from people. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you see that picture and you want to do something, but we don't know the whole story. We don't know the context. And sometimes that can be confusing.
That picture, of course, is of the little boy who drowned while he and his family were refugees from Syria, I think, or Libya. I'm not quite sure where, but yes, that went around the world.
The police officer, whatever, that was carrying him away. You know, I don't know. It seems to sum up the problem that's going on right now in my mind.
Right.
But thank you.
Right.
Thanks for your call. Let's take another one. Mary joins us from St. Louis. Go ahead, Mary.
Hi. I was calling actually twofold. Can you hear me?
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Okay. I have noticed on social media recently that both adults and children, when they post memes and then they're proven wrong by Snopes or whatever other website you might use, they don't remove them.
No.
As a matter of fact, it seems like they want to perpetuate it. And I don't – how do you combat that?
I think what you're pointing out is a real trend of people are more interested in what they believe than they are in what is true. And I think that can be really dangerous, especially during election seasons.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, Mary.
I mean, and what do you do, particularly with children? How do you make those kids understand that it's less important to perpetuate what they believe and more important to do the research and identify? You know what I'm saying? It's like you said earlier. They just want the likes.
They want the likes, right? Right.
Aren't we being irresponsible in allowing that? I mean, I can't do anything about the adults that are doing it, unfortunately. But aren't we being irresponsible as parents when we don't, for example, when we don't force them to delete something that we know is not true? Or is that helicopter parenting?
I think that would be up to parenting. And I'm really impressed if you can force your kids to do anything. I think that might be tough for some parents. And some parents might not have any clue what their kids are posting online. And that's another issue altogether.
Well, kids can block them from watching it.
I mean, absolutely.
There are all sorts of things that can happen.
Yeah.
Kids understand the use of this technology better than parents do in most cases.
Right.
Thanks so much for the call, Mary. We have an email here from Madonna in Crestwood. An interesting observation here. I'll get your take on it. The loss of Jon Stewart as the host of The Daily Show will impact our media literacy, since it seems to be a singular goal to point out the discrepancies in inflation and conflation in the political news media.
Very true. In fact, most of my college students would claim that they get 90% of their news from Jon Stewart, which, you know, it brings up another question, that line between information and entertainment, right? So I almost feel like it puts a lot of pressure on other news organizations to be entertaining in order to maintain an audience, which is hard to do. Another show that actually skewers the media in general is The Soup, mm-hmm. which is fantastic, a great media literacy show, and it skewers all media.
And it seems that some of the cable networks make it very easy for us to, because we know what the agenda is.
Sure.
We know that, you know, Fox is going to be conservative and MSNBC is going to be more liberal. So,
right.
So that's an easy one for us, right?
Right. But the problem is when we willingly put ourselves in echo chambers so that we never hear anything that contradicts what we already believe. So I encourage my students to get as news from as many different sources as possible. The problem isn't getting your news from MSNBC or Fox. The problem is only getting your news from one source. That's problematic.
Yeah. I'm going to take one more phone call before we have to wrap this up. Brent is with us. He's in St. Louis. Go ahead, Brent.
Don?
Yeah.
Google Hillary with either NPR or All Things Considered. You'll see that there's been very little. We're talking about Hillary Clinton. There's been very little reported about this email fiasco. But I do want to say that Diane Rehm did a very good presentation of this a couple of weeks ago. And I'm talking about like in the last 3 weeks since this is all blown up. And she actually kind of leaned against the candidate. She was a little bit more to the right this time. But I would like you to explain to me why this has gone so underreported by NPR.
I'm not going to talk for NPR. I would basically disagree with you, but let's take the question for what it is. Is this a good way to establish media credentials? Is to Google the Diane Rehm show or you name it, any other show, and see how many times a story has been reported?
Well, and what's interesting too is it brings up the question of access. Like when then Senator Obama was campaigning in 2008, any reporter on the press plane that was working for a newspaper that endorsed John McCain was kicked off his campaign plane. So any reporter is involved in an intricate dance with politicians because you want to ask questions, but you also want to make sure that you still have access to these people. So it's tough all the way around, yeah. Tough all the way around.
Well, it is tough, but you can make it a little bit easier to navigate this minefield, if you will. Julie Smith, the author of the book, Master the Media, How Teaching Media Literacy Can Save Our Plugged-In World. Thank you for being with us.
Thanks a lot, Don.
Coming up, do you have a reading list? We can help you add to it if you do, or help you make one if you don't. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.